From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
My guest is Kelly Weil. She's an investigative journalist at the Daily Beast, and she's just published an extraordinary new book. It's called Off the Edge, Flat Earthers, Conspiracy Culture, and Why People Will Believe Anything. Kelly Weil, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you wrote about people who believe in a flat earth and a conspiracy to cover up the fact that support that belief, because it's such an absurd belief. And but the threads that hold it together in the minds of its followers are the same threads that cause people to believe in QAnon or the lie that Biden stole the election.
That's right. You know, when I went into this project, I thought that flat earthers were sort of in a world of their own, so to speak. But as I dug into it, I found that a lot of the same thought processes that motivate even the wildest conspiracy theories also motivate a lot of the more commonplace ones, even ones that people you know might share. So it was really interesting for me to dig in and figure out what makes people tick, what makes people believe things, even when there's no logical evidence for it.
Yeah, well, your book title promises, you know, that there's a why, and you fulfill that promise brilliantly, and thank you for that. But before we understand the why, how many people do you think in 2023 believe that the Earth is flat?
That's so hard to quantify, and it's something that I really did set out to determine in this book. There has been some polling that shows that if you ask people, about 1% of adults respond with something that's, you know, supports flat earth theory. I'm not sure 1% of US adults actually believe the earth is flat. It is a fairly small, fairly niche belief. But, you know, that's not to say there aren't a lot of them in aggregate. I've been to flat earth conferences where there are 600 flat earthers in one big ballroom. And, you know, there shouldn't even be that many.
Right. You found 600 people in a room that believe the earth is flat. Well, I saw a video on Nova on PBS, and I sort of trust PBS, and I think of Nova as a program that is going to tell me factual information. And it was called Why the Towers Fell, and it explained, they had experts that knew, including one of the architects of the Twin Towers, and it explained technically why, when the planes hit the Twin Towers, they fell in the way that they did. And a good friend of mine, a guy who I really respect and love, saw some other documentary, not that one, and believes that there was a conspiracy to involved in 9/11. And when I started reading your book, I asked him if he still held this belief. This was about 20 years ago now. And he got offended that I was talking to him about it. And he said, you know, there are still a lot of unanswered questions. And for me, there weren't any unanswered questions. You know, Nova answered them for me. So why am I inclined to believe that, and my friend inclined to believe the thing that he saw on YouTube or wherever he saw it?
I think it's really challenging. And I think people come to conspiracy beliefs from a number of different angles. I think maybe the thread that underlies all conspiracy belief is the idea that the information we're presented with either doesn't answer our questions or it's insufficient. It addresses an emotional need, I think, a need for there to be some greater logic or explanation that, you know, speaks to something that we want to be true. So I have met quite a lot of people who, you know, believe alternate or, you know, incorrect explanations of the 9/11 attacks. In fact, a lot of flat earthers I spoke to said that that was their gateway into conspiracy thinking. And I think an event like that was just so disruptive for the American psyche. You know, it was something that shouldn't have been allowed to happen. I think people felt a very understandable sense of fear or moral injury. How was this allowed to happen? And I think for some people, crafting an explanation that said that this was, you know, something that our government knew about but allowed to happen, this is something that our government orchestrated even, that in its strange way is more comforting for some people than the idea that there is genuine uncertainty, the idea that these things can happen almost in a random way that we don't have a lot of means to prevent. So, you know, whereas you and I can watch a documentary that explains why the towers fell and say, okay, that answers my questions. For some people, it doesn't address the underlying emotional question of what can we do next time?
I have a question about politics and conspiracy. When the first conspiracy that I was ever, exposed to and bought into was in 1963 when President Kennedy was killed. And in 1967, a guy named Mark Lane wrote a book called Rush to Judgment. And it was the beginnings of the whole idea of not just a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy, but the whole question authority thing. And it was a real left-wing thing. All the liberals were involved in the idea that there was not only a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy and Senator Kennedy, but that, there were a lot of liars. And of course there were. I mean, President Johnson was one of the greatest liars of all time, and then topped only by President Nixon. But today, conspiracy theory is totally on the right, and it's a right-wing thing. Do you have any clue as to when it changed or why it changed?
It's such an interesting question, because I don't think there's anything inherently right-wing or left-wing about conspiracy theories. You know, there shouldn't be, and as you know, it's swung back and forth across history. One thing that is, I think, demonstrably true about conspiracy theories is they tend to be almost a coping mechanism of people who are on the losing side. People don't want to believe that something, that their team is not doing well, some identity that they've placed a stake in, be that Democrat or Republican, they don't want to believe that those are the losers. And so they craft alternate explanations that make them out to be doing a bit better in comparison to their rivals. And so I think under those conditions, like the Republicans who are sort of on the political back foot right now, rather than grapple with the fact that their message was not resonating with voters, that their candidate failed, it was easier to come up with an alternate story about themselves and say that we actually did win and that there was a sweeping plot against us and they're trying to keep us down and that we're all really on this hero's journey to, save the mole children from underground or, send Hillary Clinton to Gitmo, that sort of thing. And so I think that is probably a product of Republicans not being able to square their political reality with some very strongly held emotions in their hearts.
Yeah. Do you think that the fact that you can find a room of 600 people that believe that the earth is flat is a failure of public education? Do you think we should have vouchers? Will that be the answer?
I don't know that that school vouchers are going to solve any conspiracy problem. I do think there are some public education issues here. A lot of people don't graduate with a very strong understanding of, scientific facts that they learned in school. Frankly, a lot of flat earthers are big into the homeschool movement, so they are teaching their kids that Earth is flat. That said, I don't know that flat Earth, or really any conspiracy theory, is necessarily the product of people being stupid. I've met flat earthers with master's degrees. Granted, those are in divinity and things that are, a little bit less scientifically grounded. But I think it's a mistake to broadly write off everybody as, ill-informed. These people aren't choosing these theories because they're the most logical. They're choosing them because they're emotionally satisfying. And so, yes, I am a huge proponent of better public schools and, teaching people the scientific underpinnings of our world. But I think we also need to, combat why people might go looking for these bizarre theories that completely fly in the face of everything you learn from grades K through 12.
Well, I was a public school teacher for about 30 years. I taught middle school. Now I teach at Monterey Peninsula College. But the parents and the reaction of parents to teachers is also really different now than it was when I was in school. When I was in school, whatever the teachers did or said, our parents backed them 100% and said, even if they hit us, which they used to do, My mother would say, well, I'm sure you deserved it. You know, that was the thing. Whereas now, it's like parents and students against teachers to a certain extent, and that almost anything teachers do is up for criticism by parents. There's even talk about asking parents what they think teachers should teach in the classroom and so on. I'm not sure exactly what I'm asking, but you know, does this lead to people believing the earth is flat?
You know, I'm actually really glad you're asking this because, you know, right now when we're talking, I'm don't tell my bosses, I'm sneaking away from my day job where I'm actually looking at a story very closely related to this. I think there are definitely political campaigns against public education. Some of those are very explicit. I've talked to people in the John Birch Society who say that, yeah, we don't want there to be public schools, period. And, you know, they work with more local conservative activists, the kinds of people who are going to harass school board members at meetings, the kind of people who are going to report their teachers to the, you know, Sunday night news for, I don't know, being gay or something like that. I do think there's a coordinated and somewhat grassroots onslaught on public education. And, you know, I think that's sometimes for cynical reasons. There is, you know, objectively, there's a lot of like charter school money going into backing these just really silly fights. And I think that also a lot of these political actors understand that schools are a space where children can form their own identity. They can learn things on their own terms, and that they're, you know, not necessarily obliged to believe what their parents believe. They can learn and think for themselves. And I think we're seeing a conservative movement that frankly doesn't like that. And so that tars a lot of public education as, you know, oh, gender ideology, inappropriate race ideology. And I think that's just a huge mischaracterization of what children are being allowed to think about. And so, you know, it's not exactly the same thing as teaching flat earth in schools, but I do think there's probably a through line there, you know, refusing to give people the facts and the reality they need and they deserve to navigate the world.
When I was teaching social studies, you know, part of the eighth grade social studies curriculum involves teaching the Renaissance and the Reformation and the rise of Islam and so forth. And I had a parent who was angry with me who said, you know, my daughter's a Christian and I don't want her questioning that. The answer that I gave was, I'm sorry, but, you know, what I wanted to say was, well, don't let her out of the house then. it is kind of frightening that people are afraid of the truth. What about the people that you've studied in the flat earth world? How afraid are they of being proved wrong? Or they don't seem, it doesn't seem to be possible to prove them wrong.
Yes and no. I mean, I can tell you one of the very few people I've spoken to in the flat earth movement who admitted that he was wrong, he left. He spoke explicitly about that fear to me. He said that when he started feeling doubts about flat earth, he was afraid to even look at the sunset because he knew that the way that the sun sets, you know, degree over degree over the horizon, disproves the theory. I mean, this was a man who was so afraid of confronting that reality in his head that he became afraid of the sky. But, you know, I'm tremendously grateful for him and the other ex-flat earthers who spoke to me, because I think it takes a lot of courage to admit that you're wrong, especially about something that people tend to think is funny, like flat earth. But a lot of current flat earthers I spoke to were definitely very, I think, afraid of confronting some of those realities. And that's why they lean so heavily on the flat earth community, the people who go to these movements, the people who hang out on these all-night Skype calls with fellow believers. They want, you know, a circle of people, a community that reinforces those beliefs, that isn't going to tear them down, that isn't going to tell them that they're being silly. And yeah, I think, you know, it's a fear of being hurt. It's a fear of vulnerability. And I think it ultimately shrinks people's world and their social setting to a very small point.
Well, you write in your book, Kelly, while off the edge, flat earthers, conspiracy culture, and why people will believe anything, that 2014, almost all the people who are flat earth believers today became flat earth believers in 2014. That's just such a strange idea. Why 2014? What happened in 2014?
I mean, I hate to be reductive, but it was YouTube. It was almost completely a YouTube-based discovery for all of them. YouTube used to work. It still does work to this extent. Basically, if you're watching a video, it recommends other videos that you might be interested in. And often it recommends things that are just a little bit spicier than the thing you're watching. So a very real YouTube path that people described for me is they're watching 9/11 trutherism videos, and YouTube recommended Flat Earth for them. 2014 is around the time that people started, you know, putting out the first Flat Earth videos. And because Flat Earth is so weird, it's so scintillating, it makes even people like me say, what is that? I want to click on it on the sidebar. Those videos performed phenomenally well on YouTube. So it was a self-perpetuating cycle of people making these videos because they performed well, those videos showing up higher in the search results and the recommendations because they performed well, and more people discovering it. Now, I did mention early in my answer that this is how the recommendations used to work. It still works sort of like that, but there's been such a diagnosable issue with Flat Earth on YouTube that YouTube actually tweaked the algorithm to remove Flat Earth and a couple other harmful conspiracy theories from its recommendations. So it's harder to find now. But I mean, it was a very real case of, a certain technology driving people to this completely ludicrous theory.
Well, you spent a lot of time talking about this in your book, but how do conspiracies, they all seem to originate with Jews and anti-Semitic hostility. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think conspiracy theories often look for a person to blame, a person who's orchestrating the cover-up, a scapegoat, you know, someone who you can point to and say it's their fault. It doesn't necessarily have to be Jews, but man, throughout the history of, all of Europe does it tend to be Jews. And, you know, it's because they're a recognizable religious minority, people who, due to discriminatory laws, were forced to live apart and, you know, removed from other society. So yeah, it makes sense. You know, it's in medieval times, there were conspiracy theories about, you know, Jews sucking blood from children, or they blamed things like the Black Death on Jews poisoning the water supply. So every time there was a real issue, a moral panic, a literal plague, it was very easy to point the finger at this group that nobody really seemed to know because they weren't allowed to integrate, really. And I think the shape of that has changed a bit. You know, obviously, I'm someone of Jewish heritage. I think I'm quite commingled, but it's those anti-Semitic strains still exist, I think, in a lot of conspiratorial thinking. And even if they're not as immediately recognizable, even if people don't always, you know, say it explicitly, although they do say it quite explicitly sometimes, some of the bigoted DNA is still there. And in theories like QAnon, which falsely accuses Democrats of drinking babies' blood, you can tie that pretty neatly back to medieval theories of blood libel against Jews.
How bad is anti-Semitic hostility in America today? Is it time for me to move?
I wouldn't say so. I don't know. You know, I cover extremism, right? So I do think my perspective here is a little distorted. Listen, I'm a person with a recognizably Jewish last name writing about neo-Nazis. So my emails are a little dicey, as you can imagine. I do think it's a worrisome moment. I think that a lot of implicit anti-Semitism has been allowed or, you know, even condoned. I think we're really in a moment where we need to draw a line and, you know, we need to say that this sort of thing is inappropriate. It's not something we'll tolerate in our communities. So I think it's ascendant. I'm not personally worried, but I certainly can't make judgments for other people.
Well, I mean, you know, there is a thing I'm sure it's happened to you. I mean, as we study Nazi Germany in the past and we think, well, why didn't those people leave? And, you know, we have learned that it's not so easy to leave. But that question is, you know, why did they stay as long as they did to the point where they were rounded up and killed? And that's a question I think, you know, American Jews have to ponder.
Yeah, I mean, we tend toward normalcy. I mean, even if things got extremely bad, well, I have a home loan, you know, I have a mortgage. That would be a real pain. And, you know, it's very hard to tell the moment when things are going too wrong. I think if I were to, you know, point to a group that's really going through it, I think it really experiencing more of an explicit threat than Jewish people right now is the transgender community. There are really, really frightening laws either on the books or emerging, you know, speeding through state legislatures that make it very difficult and dangerous, I think, to be a transgender person. It is putting a target on their backs. And so I think, you know, now is a moment where we, you know, we ask, why didn't people stand up in Nazi Germany? I think there's a real parallel to be drawn here in this moment for that community. And so it is heartening to me to see pushback against, you know, these laws, these bigoted groups targeting schools, et cetera. But yes, to your point, it's frightening.
I guess that related to that is the fact that the recent bank failures in California, New York, were blamed on wokeness. Did you catch that? I'm sure you did.
I did. And it's tremendous to me because, I mean, you read any financial paper and they'll tell you exactly what happened there. You know, the bank had a very undiversified portfolio. And when the Fed adjusted interest rates, they had to fundraise more money and VCs panicked and took their money out of the banks. That's, you know, that's pretty straightforward. That's pretty cut and dry. But I think because so many of those same VCs and those same libertarian types are against any sort of regulation, any kind of some of the regulations that were rolled back in 2018 that may have possibly prevented this sort of collapse, they don't want to reflect on that. They don't want to concede that that would be, you know, a meaningful change going forward. So what do? They look and they say, well, what's our grievance of the day? It's woke culture. And it's easy for me to laugh about that, but I think there are some actually specific and frightening ramifications for that. I've seen a lot of people on the right go digging through Silicon Valley Bank's staffing list and point to one. She's not even based in the U.S. She's based in Europe, but a woman of color who's in somewhere in their executive structure, and she has some language in her bio about, you know, fostering LGBTQ colleagues. And people said, "Aha, that's the woke one." And I said, "Is it a coincidence that you have in your witch hunt for woke people, you've isolated one of, I suspect, your very few, you know, women of color in the executive suite?" It's just, it is I don't think it's slick what they're trying there.
When you started your investigation into flat earth and conspiracy culture, President Trump had not been elected president yet. Is that right?
I think when I put a concerted effort into flat earth, he had, but I've been spending time in the conspiracy world, you're right, since long before Trump was elected. I've been just very interested in fringe internet communities for a long time, long before I was doing much reporting on politics. But something that happened, you know, as Trump was ascendant, was that these weird, kind of grungy internet communities I was looking at, sort of the 4chans, that sort of thing, became very politically driven. They became, I think, core to a lot of this Trump's momentum online. And so, yes, I think that kind of conspiracy energy there really fueled his first presidential campaign. And it's one of those things where you start off as, you know, the newsroom's meme correspondent, and suddenly you're explaining what Trump's talking about at a campaign rally.
Do you think that will hold? I mean, was he enabling a lot of conspiracy theory? How did it interact, do you think?
Absolutely. Trump is almost a perfect president for a conspiratorial age. He, I think, very genuinely believes a lot of conspiracy theories about himself, even when they don't align with his lived experiences. You know, you can now go back via many lawsuits with extensive discovery. You can go back and you can read the records, what his aides were telling him after he lost, which is, "You lost. That's it." And time and time again, he says, oh, no, that's not possible. You know, we're going to go and, you know, make hay in Michigan. We're going to hold up results in Arizona. So I think this kind of conspiracy thinking is both central to how he campaigns, how he disputes the results of elections, but also the way he builds community around his movement. He uses conspiracy theories to instill a sense of grievance in his followers, say that someone is out to get you, but I'm on your side. You know, I've got your back. We're all in this together, fighting against this other. And that's where I think conspiracy theories can be a cohesive glue for a political movement.
His wide range of interests in conspiracy theories, from low-flow toilets to whatever, it's like a reaching out to the American people, a conspiracy in every pot, you know, kind of thing.
It is. You know, that's one thing that I think is very interesting about how conspiracy theories have changed since I've been monitoring them. Around 2017, when I really started focusing on flat earth, I noticed that these conspiracy movements were a bit more siloed. They're a bit more distinct from each other. If I was on a flat earth Facebook page, it would mostly be talking about flat earth. And since then, and across the Trump presidency, I saw a bit of a singularity happening. These theories bleeding across their borders, talking to each other, adopting arguments from each other. And so now it's I think, speak to that base, you can kind of offer a conspiracy buffet. You can be talking about the toilets for people who think it's funny, or talking about some things that I think are kind of bloodthirsty, things like QAnon, things like, you know, pretty threatening messages for local elections officials. So they really, they run the gamut these days.
So do you think that QAnon, whoever is behind QAnon, or I don't know how many QAnon followers there are, but they're actively infiltrating other conspiracies to further their own conspiracies? Is that a thing that they do?
To a small degree, absolutely. I can give you a very literal example of this. I was at a Flat Earth conference in late 2019, kind of right before everything shut down for COVID. And I'm standing around, you know, I'm making small talk, and two women approach me, and one gives me a little bracelet. I'm like, what is this? And it's like a Livestrong bracelet, but it's got a QAnon slogan on it. It's got a little dangly Q. I said, are you actual flat earthers? And they go, no, we're here to tell people about Q, and we just think that flat earthers are going to be receptive to our message. And that was, that blew my mind. I think most of the bleed over is, you know, just, it's kind of incidental. It's affinity groups and, you know, people wanting to talk to other conspiracy theorists. But yes, there are some concerted efforts to recruit.
Gosh, you know, that just makes me think the key difference between politics of the past and politics now. That is, it used to be that people subscribed to a political point of view because they heard facts, not alternative facts, but actual facts, and they would then analyze those facts and hold an idea that other people held, and therefore they would group together in a political party. That is, Republicans believed in small government and Democrats believed in a larger government and so on. But now it's like a religion. That is, people believe in their side and nothing you can say to them will change their mind, just as there's nothing you can say to somebody who believes in Jesus Christ. There's nothing you can say to them that will make them change their mind, and there's nothing you can say to somebody who doesn't believe that will make them believe. So religious groups like, you know, Seventh-day Adventists and Mormons, they've always had that thing where they go around door to door and they give people stuff, or they stand at the airport and they try to give you stuff. And so they're giving you these little QAnon bracelets, and it's really like a religious recruiting stand. And it gives me a very hopeless feeling, actually, about politics. Where can we go? What can we do about all this, Kelly? Wow.
I'm sorry to make you feel hopeless. I'm doing my best. no, you know, I think you're very right to liken people's political beliefs to religious beliefs right now, because I think a lot of those beliefs are part of someone's identity. They're not just someone's ideas that they hold. They don't say, I think, you know, universal healthcare on the balance would be good. Or they don't say that, you know, I think there should be lower taxes on businesses. it becomes part of their identity, who they are, to be Team Red or Team Blue. And I think that's a lot harder to shake in someone than, you know, a well-reasoned argument that you could, you know, present pros and cons to. And conspiracy belief works, I think, in a lot of similar ways. This belief that they hold becomes part of their identity. They're not just someone who subscribes to flat earth theory. They are a flat earther. One possible avenue for hope, though, is I've spoken to enough people now who say that because a conspiracy belief to that level is addressing some kind of unmet need, it's addressing someone's desire to belong to something, some truth-seeking movement, it's speaking to someone's desire to solve problems or have community, that maybe you can replace that in a holistic way. And so some funny examples I've encountered are someone who said, my aunt was really into QAnon because she liked the idea that she was decoding riddles online. And you know what broke her out of it? It was playing Wordle on the New York Times. What doesn't Wordle solve? Somebody else said that a relative was very into a similar conspiracy theory and liked her online community around it. And instead she got very into K-pop, you know, Korean pop music scene, which comes with a very hardcore fan base. And she just got into that, you know, making fan videos with other people and talking, and it kind of supplanted whatever conspiracy theories were providing her. So I think, you know, it's not a one size fits all solution, but if you can find out what's driving someone to conspiracy theory and maybe offer up something that meets that same need.
Yeah, Wordle is a very community-building thing because you can share your results with your friends, and you can only play once a day, and all that. And you can take pride in solving it in three when your sister solved it in five. You spent some time in your book, Off the Edge: Flat Earthers, Conspiracy Culture, and Why People Will Believe Anything. Kelly Weil, you spent some time talking about this, about the pandemic and about the plandemic. Film, and you even tie it back to that anti-Semitic idea of Jews poisoning the well, that we were so divided that this thing happened to all of us, and instead of bringing us together, it radically split us apart into this anti-vax and vax and mask and anti-mask, and it's still with us. I mean, it seems like the pandemic now is receding, but not the divisions it caused.
Absolutely. You know, we talk about conspiratorial moments, and what does seem to prompt a rise in conspiracy theories are moments of instability, moments when people are frightened and they're looking for easy answers or soothing answers, something like that. And so the pandemic just caused this rupture in people's lives. People were frightened, and they went looking for, you know, for answers that were soothing to them. So if that meant, and you know, I had a baby about 2 months before lockdown. So I was in a bunch of parenting groups on Facebook, and I saw these groups go from quite normal discussions of raising children to really counter-scientific, you know, pseudo cures and medically inadvisable things you could do to keep your family safe. And while that was frustrating for me to watch develop, it was also understandable because it was happening in this moment where doctors couldn't tell you very much empirically about what you could do for a kid who had COVID. There just wasn't enough information yet. So people in that void of information and that void of answers were making up their own. And I think that just, you know, continued on a wild trajectory and, you know, fused very neatly with politics, you know, libertarian ideas of I shouldn't have to get a vaccine or wear a mask to protect my neighbor. I make my own choices. And so, yeah, I think people's fear in that moment, it knotted together very nicely with their political identities, and we haven't been able to disentangle that yet.
President Trump's defensiveness about it was also baffling. You know, these numbers aren't our fault, or why not? If you just stop testing, then we wouldn't have so many people. It's a It's not something that I ever expected to have happen in terms of the leadership in the country having an attitude of that type toward what we're going through.
It was very frustrating. Yeah, and I think it was just very unfortunate, maybe like the most ill-suited president we could have had in that moment. And I think, you know, the president is not immune from the same conspiratorial impulses that everybody else has. He wants to feel good about himself. And so he'll suggest that this is, you know, a bioweapon from China. It's not something that we had anything to do with. Or he'll suggest, you know, counter scientific cures, the idea that you could use bleach to fight COVID. I mean, these things are completely illogical, but they're coming from the same place that a flat earther comes from when they say that, you know, the New World Order is covering up the shape of the earth. And in order to, you know, free your mind, you should listen to 8 hours of Alex Jones every day, that sort of thing. It's unfortunately, we just happened to have a conspiracy theorist in office when that virus broke out.
Yeah, unfortunately. Now, in your book, you appear. Yeah, I mean, you're a reporter. You're an investigative reporter. And it doesn't happen until kind of occasionally it happens, but it happens kind of later on in your book where I was, you know, the word I appears and you tell some stories about you. Was that a decision that you had to make about your writing to involve yourself?
It was. And pardon me. It was. And it was interesting, too, because as a day-to-day journalist, I don't typically involve myself in a story. I like to, you know, keep myself at a little bit of a remove. I don't think readers necessarily are interested in, you know, in the details of my life. And I had a phenomenal editor who said, you should step into this a little bit more. Part of the narrative, I just, you know, happened 150 years before I was born. This book starts off in the 1840s in the UK with the birth of the modern flat earth movement.
But wait a minute, you weren't there?
I mean, I could be a vampire much older than I appear. as it progressed into later events where I was in the flat earth scene, and I think it's almost a disservice to hide that, you know, I was talking to people for years. I was texting with people I knew, you know, they died, they had relationships and falling outs, and these things all happened, you know, while I was in contact with them. So I thought it was sort of fair to, you know, keep myself in the scene a little bit and just to show the proximity and to show that, you know, these weren't necessarily wackos. These were people who I could have a, you know, year and a half text thread with. And it was just part of my reporting process.
You're still reporting every day in the Daily Beast. And you do write about things that are, especially in this book, that are challenging people's beliefs, that these are beliefs that they're holding on to for dear life. Are you ever afraid that somebody will want to hurt you or strike out at you?
Not especially. I guess it's always a dim concern. I do things like, you know, try and, I don't post pictures of my children online, that sort of thing. Not especially. I don't have a really ready-made answer for that. I'm an advocate for sanity. I am an advocate for de-escalation, and, you know, it's very easy to find my email or my phone number, and I will actually, you know, I will chat things through with people to the extent that they want to be civil and rational about them. So, listen, are there people who are a bit aggressive? Yes. Unfortunately, during my my wedding rehearsal dinner, somebody tried to get into my office at the Daily Beast claiming they had an interview with me with some aggrieved right-wing person. And that's about as far as it's got. So I've been, you know, part of me wants to stay fortunate. Part of me thinks that a lot of the talk that people do online is all bluster. I don't know. Maybe famous last words.
No, I hope you're right. Absolutely. What about another book? Are you going to write another book?
That's a really good question. I've described what I'm doing right now as a sanity break. I loved the process of writing this. It was really freeing and interesting to be able to do what I love, which is reporting and talking to people and writing, but at so much of a greater length to really explore a topic to its full depth. I loved that. So I think ultimately down the line, I would like to, but right now I'm you know, just kind of decompressing from this one and still answering some emails from flat earthers.
One of the things that you did in this book that it was so great and why I want everybody to read it is you really take a lot of diverse threads and historical facts. And that's the thing. It's like you're seemingly talking about something that is, well, who cares about flat earthers? How could there even be that? But, and then you answer that question, well, you should care because flat earthers represent this much larger population. And I wonder, how were you able to keep it all straight? Did you have some kind of a, like a board in your office with colored threads? How did you weave it all together and keep a hold on what your goal was?
I had a Google document from hell and what my husband called as called the nest, which was all my papers that were distributed around. I'm a bit of a magpie for information and links and everything. So to the best that I can, I try and throw everything in a big Word document and, you know, put some structuring in. I'm sitting next to my closet right now. I have huge shoe boxes in there with notepads and flat earth paraphernalia that people have given me. So, I'll never make a claim to being the most organized person in the world, but in bits and pieces and, you know, disparate Word documents, it did all come together.
Well, I'm glad it did, and congratulations. The book is called Off the Edge, Flat Earthers, Conspiracy Culture, and Why People Will Believe Anything. And the author, the brilliant Kelly Weil, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's a new book that I want to tell you about that's so nostalgic. I just love it. It's called Lost Restaurants of Santa Cruz County. And the author is Liz Pollack, and she's a bookseller as well as the author of this little gem. Liz Pollack, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you so much for having me as a guest. I appreciate it.
Well, I love this book. How did you come up with this idea?
You know, my thing to collect is vintage restaurant menus and cocktail menus and wine lists, and I have a lot from Santa Cruz, the city and the county and Aptos and all that. And I was looking at some very closely, and I saw this little blurb on the bottom that was printed, the ceiling prices are available for anyone who wants to see them, and they're posted by a rule of the Office of Price Administration. And I didn't really know what that was, and so I researched that a little bit. And so in the 40s, because of World War II and the ration coupons, restaurants were also it was imposed on them to get ration coupons, which they did, but at a 20-30% more allotment. But in doing so, they had to post these posters and little blurbs in their menus that whatever they I could go on and on, but whatever they charged was going to be that way for the year. They couldn't, like, you know, jack up their prices or something. And that was a way to regulate fairness. But it was tough. And so I invested that, and then I started writing, and the book kind of built up from there. I interviewed 78 people. And I covered about 200 restaurants.
It's just a great little book, and like I say, it's very nostalgic. And I was reading about the author part, and you and I came to Santa Cruz the same year, 1975.
Awesome.
And my first trip to Santa Cruz was in 1973, and I think the first restaurant where I ate was the Broken Egg.
Oh yeah.
And then there were two Broken Eggs, but this was the original Broken Egg.
which was underneath.
Mary Hutcherson, yeah.
Yeah, underneath the staircase massage parlor.
Right near the, it was fantastic because they were really, added a lot of fresh vegetables. They really emphasized everything was fresh, and it was a meeting place. It was a happening place, and I had the great joy of interviewing Alan McLean, who that was one of his favorite places to go. He's the youngest son of Huldah Hoover McLean, and he graciously talked about all the restaurants he remembers going to. He was a great person to interview. It was my honor to interview the people in my book, whether they were, they worked in restaurants for a short time or they were part of the family that owned and managed the places.
And, you know, some of the wait staff in some of these places also became our friends and we knew them. Well, let me ask you about a few restaurants that I love. There's one restaurant missing from your book that I really loved, which is a restaurant called the Pepper Mill.
I'm sorry.
Do you remember that?
I remember that.
Yeah.
Sure.
It was on Pacific Avenue.
What did you like to order there?
They had open-face turkey sandwiches and open-face roast beef sandwiches.
Dang. Yeah. Sounds good.
It was like a cafeteria, kind of. I mean, it was like a little, it was a cafeteria, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, it's where the Barceloneta is right now, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, when I came here, I was so involved at UC Santa Cruz, and that's where I ate at the Whole Earth Restaurant, and I had the joy of interviewing Paul Lee about his involvement in the restaurant and how what great connection it was with the Alan Chadwick Garden, and that it was the first of the UC system, and in fact, you know, any colleges that he could think of to use the local college garden, in French intensive organic garden, as a purveyor for the restaurant on the campus.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
What is the oldest existing restaurant in Santa Cruz? Do you know?
Dagnero's Fish at the end of the wharf.
Uh-huh. You're right. That's an old one.
Right. Fantastic.
Of course, now all the restaurants. Maybe we won't have any restaurants anymore. Who knows?
Well, one of the things that I'm talking about is through the decades, the flexibility or the initiative of how restaurants can work around, a problem. The creative new thing of this curbside pickup is so incredible. I mean, I love this. It takes a little bit of planning, but it reminds me of in my chapter on the car hops and the drive-ins in the 50s, of when the restaurant owner would extend the parking lot and have the waitresses roller skate out to the car and utilize, if their dining room was full, then they'd utilize the parking lot as an extra dining room.
Isn't that crazy? Well, no. They don't come out in roller skates now, but maybe they'll reinvent that. I want to ask you about Chef Tong. He was an important person who brought Szechuan cooking. I thought he was the first to bring Szechuan food to Santa Cruz, and I think he originally cooked at the New Riverside Hotel.
Right. And he got rave reviews from restaurant critics as possibly the first, if not the very first person to really champion Szechuan food in Northern California. It was a big, huge draw to Santa Cruz. I mean, tourists discovered it, and he came out with a book, and I think he came out with some bottled sauces and spices as well.
He was a great guy, a very nice guy. And I remember that he had a restaurant near Pacific Avenue. You have one listed on 41st Avenue. I didn't remember that he had one there. But didn't he have one off Pacific as well?
That I don't know. I'm not sure. I'll look that up. I'm not sure about that.
I think he had one downtown. Yeah, I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. But yeah, he was a great guy, and that was a revolution in food. And then the China Szechuan, which was...
Oh, my goodness.
The China Szechuan was... That was another restaurant before that. What was it called before it was the China Szechuan? Now it's...
It was the Downtowner.
The Downtowner, right.
they
had sandwiches and stuff.
Right, and is near the Penny's department store catalog place where you could... order from the catalog and pick it up there.
Right.
But the China Szechuan was fantastic.
Oh, I loved it. I was so sad when they closed.
They
closed voluntarily. They decided to retire, I believe.
Did you ever work at a restaurant yourself?
I had the shortest restaurant career in history. I worked at a restaurant called Tiny's, which is where the IHOP is now, and I was a busboy there, and I was fired after one night because I was so terrible at it.
Well, then that's the thing. It's like when I was a bartender at Adolph's Italian Family Restaurant from 85 to 1990, there were a lot of waiters and waitresses who, you know, I mean, we all depended on each other, and we had work ethic and all. So there was this guy who'd come, and his shirt was clean. It was always wrinkled. And so the manager, Polly Blondie, she said, Liz, you know, go in there and help him iron his shirt or something. So and they had an ironing board set up. And I ironed a shirt, and then I married the guy. So, I mean, you meet a lot of people and make a lot of friends at restaurants.
Well, one of my very good friends, Tim, used to be a waiter at Casablanca, and another good friend of mine, Melanie, was a waitress at the Teacup.
Oh, nice.
And my friend Diane was a waitress at India Joe's. So, yeah, I knew all the people there.
Sure.
And some people, they were just our friends because we went in there and ate there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And a lot of decisions get made there. One of the features that I enjoyed researching was that, you know, Rotary and Elks and all the awards and all the functions, all these monthly meetings brought in a steady income, but it's the bridal showers and the bachelorette parties and all that stuff. It's a big deal.
It is
huge
deal. Yeah, one of my favorite restaurants I want to ask you about was the Grape Steak. It was on 41st Avenue, where Cafe Cruz is now.
Uh huh.
And that was such a great place where you would make your own steak, and there was a great big vat of baked beans there.
Oh, my goodness. It was and really fresh food, the best meat, really high-quality meat. One of the things I loved to do was promote the idea that it's really the purveyors that keep the business humming. You know, the Sur City Produce, Coast Produce in Watsonville, when they come in, they you don't have to call them for the season. They know what you want. They know what you need. They the computers help that and everything, but it's this community support with the people who, you know, promote the wine and beer but I enjoyed my interviews with the purveyors as well in Santa Cruz.
The Del Marette was another favorite of mine. In fact, my friend Ava Brzezinski made a film about the original Del Marette. It was such a great little hamburger place. I just loved it. And I worked at Logo, so it was right across the street. I used to eat at the Del Marette all the time. What a great old-fashioned Santa Cruz eatery that was.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
In fact, I remember once at Logos, my co-worker Debbie and I had gone to the China Szechuan, and we had a huge feast that was set up on the back counter there while we were working one evening. And somebody came in like eating an apple or something, and Debbie said, "There's no food allowed in here."
Well, I miss Logos.
Me too. And I miss all these restaurants that you bring to life in this book. It's a wonderful book, Lost Restaurants of Santa Cruz County, and the author has been my guest here, Liz Pollack. Liz, thank you so much for visiting and talking about this book. Where can we find this book, by the way?
Well, you can find it at all independent, locally owned bookstores. Thank you very much. If you could avoid the megastore that begins with the first letter of the alphabet, I appreciate that. Of course, the Cook's Bookcase, which is a local independently owned bookstore, carries it, and I own the bookstore, and I offer free shipping.
So can people around, because, you know, From the Bookshelf has a worldwide audience, so people around the world can contact your store in what manner?
Cooksbookcase.com, and as well as my phone number, which is 831-251-9218.
Well, thank you so much, Liz, and I hope a lot of people pick up this book because it's really wonderful.
Thank you so much, Gary. It was a pleasure talking with you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.